Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve is in conversation with Dr. Carrie Perlson, Executive Director of Cybersecurity at the MIT Sloan Research Consortium. Carrie tells Steve about her research, which focuses on building a culture of cybersecurity and the role leadership plays in that process. Throughout the discussion, she shares lots of practical tips and examples from case studies.
Carrie, thank you very much indeed for joining me on the podcast today. Lovely to catch up. Wanted to talk to you about culture and cybersecurity. Now, your current research studies how organizations are building a culture of cybersecurity. To get us started, tell us a little bit about that. What does that involve?
Certainly. Thanks, Steve. So let me just give you a quick background. I am the executive director of a research group here at MIT called Cybersecurity at MIT Sloan. And we look at the organizational, managerial, strategic, governance kinds of questions in cybersecurity. And one of the things I noticed a few years ago was that with all the discussion of risk and all the discussion of threats and vulnerabilities, people kept coming up as the top threat. Our members, the companies that support our research, kept saying, you know, we just can't seem to get our people in line. We train them, we put awareness programs in place, but we still have people doing things, maybe inadvertently, that cause a cyber vulnerability or a threat or maybe worse, an actual attack. Right. So we spun up this research project to take a look at what we call building a culture of cybersecurity. And in my world, culture means the values, attitudes, and beliefs that drive cybersecure behaviors. So we want to do something that drives values, attitudes, and beliefs. Now, training is certainly a piece of that. And awareness programs is another piece of that. But if that was enough, we wouldn't be having this discussion today. People would have solved the people problem, the organization problem, and people would be doing the right thing. So the question is, what drives values, attitudes, and beliefs so that we can drive cybersecure behaviors? If you'd like, I can go into more detail on that.
Yeah, sure. Please do. Because I mean, that is one of the things that I suppose people ask me the most, because to the point you've just made, you know, they are implementing awareness programs. Increasingly, they're still trying to grapple with hybrid environments. Should they be hybrid? Should they be in one location? All of that sort of stuff. So yeah, tell us a little bit about that, because I think that's going to be really interesting for our listeners.
Certainly. So we want to drive cybersecure behaviors. What does that look like? Well, it's a little different in every organization, but just in general, we want to make sure people don't click on phishing emails. People don't stick a thumb drive into their computer that they don't know about. They don't click on a link that they don't know. They don't send money to somebody just because the email looks like their boss wants them to send money. I mean, there's a number of behaviors we want to drive. Maybe we even want to drive things like people talking about cybersecurity so that it shines light on it. You know, why are we keeping it in the dark and thinking that it's a bad infrastructure thing when it really could be part of the ether and part of the conversation we're having? We're seeing headlines all the time about cybersecurity breaches. Those are teaching moments. So the question is, what can we do to drive values, attitudes, and beliefs? And we believe that you can do a number of things as a manager. Well, there's some things you can't do. Let me start there. You're in certain industries. You might be in financial services or healthcare, and you have regulations. There's certain things you have to do. Those are table stakes. If you're in, let's say, financial services, you're a bank, nobody's going to do business with a bank they don't trust. So you already have a set of values, attitudes, and beliefs that drive certain behaviors and certain thinking. But there are many organizations that don't have those kinds of, I would say, industry cultures, or they're located in countries, perhaps, where the cultural, the norms are a little different. You can't control those as a manager, but you can control things like how you involve people in cybersecurity discussions. For example, in one company we looked at in Brazil, it's a bank, and the CEO starts every all-hands meeting with a cybersecurity moment. Now, to me, that was really insightful. Not only is it bringing cybersecurity to light and talking about things that might influence the way people think about cybersecurity, but by the CEO doing this, rather than, say, the CISO or the CIO, he's sending a very clear message that this is a priority for him. And if it's a priority for him, it becomes a priority for other people just simply because he raises the question and he brings it up in his meetings. Now, the fact that he takes 5 minutes out of his all hands meeting, yeah, that's a significant amount of time over the year. And so it really is showing the people in the organization, not only can they learn from the words, but just the mere fact that he does that impacts the values, attitudes, and beliefs of others in the organization. So that's one example. And another example, a company hired a marketing person to lead their cybersecurity culture activities. I thought that was really brilliant because what do marketing people do? Well, they change hearts and minds, and they have all sorts of attitudes and tools and thought processes to change the way people think and the way people act. And this person brought in a number of devices, if you will. Of course, there's training programs, that's table stakes. Of course, there's communication programs and awareness programs. Again, for most companies, that's table stakes. But she implemented a lot more things. One thing she did is she changed the language around cybersecurity. They don't call it cybersecurity in her company. They call it data protection. Now, you may say, well, what's the difference? But for the average person sitting in an organization, cybersecurity is something they shake their head. Yeah, it's great. We all have moms. Moms are great. We all, you know, have our favorite dessert. Dessert's great. But to actually describe it in a way that we all relate is very different. We all have a different image of what our moms are like or what dessert is like and what cybersecurity means. But by calling it data protection, all of a sudden, everybody in the organization can hone in on the fact that in their company, protecting data is really important because that's what it's called, data protection. And many of the activities that they put in place are designed to show people how to protect data. So you may say, well, it's just training and awareness programs, but it really was fundamentally different in that case because they actually changed the language about it and made it something that everyone could access even if they hadn't had the latest training or compliance programs.
I like that example because I'm a marketing person myself, so I can relate very easily to that. And I think that's the key, isn't it? It's about that being able to relate rather than just going through a process for the sake of it, understanding why. I think your CEO example is great as well, because that's, you know, one of the things I think that people don't do enough of is explain, you know, to take the time to put that into the context for the organization. So I think those are two great examples there. Let's look a little bit about some organizational structure, though. So we talked a bit about, you know, that leadership. Are there any structural adjustments that an organization can make in this area, do you think?
I think it's really important to have somebody own cybersecurity culture. If they don't, every time I've asked an organization who owns it, it usually points, unless there's a specific role, it points to the CISO. And while I think CISOs are amazing and do amazing work, everything points to the CISO. Can't do everything. And if it's not your primary job, then it's nobody's primary job. So while I think the CISO or the CIO or whoever the senior cybersecurity compliance person is important in getting a culture, I think that you need to have a particular person involved that owns building culture. And if you don't have that, then really what happens is it just becomes, in some cases, a 5-minute discussion once a month or once a year. It's just not, you just don't put the resource behind it. So I think structurally you need someone that owns it. Also, I think another tool I've seen used are performance rewards and, if you will, punishments or readjustments. One organization I know, they rewarded people who did cybersecurity activities, whether that was reporting a phishing email or maybe even running a seminar in their own little organization about cybersecurity, even though they aren't cyber people. They would reward them for cyber positive behaviors. What that does is it creates the attitude of, wow, this is something important. This is good. Do more of it. I've also seen organizations punish, if you will, or have consequences for bad cyber behavior. In one organization we looked at, if you clicked on a phishing email, well, it was an OT environment, operational technology environment. So introducing a malware could actually blow up stuff. People could get harmed. Right. Systems could get physically harmed. So it was really critical for them not to have malware introduced into the system. So they had a policy. If you clicked on a phishing email, the first time you got what most of us get, a little, you know, 15-minute compliance training to remind you not to do it. The second time you got a little bit longer training program. The third time you met with your boss, the fourth time with HR. And the fifth time, if you're a habitual clicker, you were fired. And that really didn't take very many people to get fired for people to get the message that this is not okay in this environment. And that structural change, performance reviews, performance rewards, and consequences changed the culture in that particular organization. Now, I'm not saying everybody needs to fire people who click on phishing emails. Don't take that message away. The message to take away is if there's consequences, then that changes attitudes and values and beliefs.
Yeah, and in that instance, of course, there is that ultimate sanction at the end, isn't there, which really does reinforce the importance to the organization. One of the things that people continually talk to me about is the challenge they face of trying to educate not just their own organization, but the much larger expanded organization, if you like, stakeholders, supply chains. What can organizations do to influence and improve security in that much more extended way?
Yeah, that's a really tough question. The whole ecosystem is, of course, a vulnerability to every company today. Our supply chain cyber vulnerabilities are really what many of us haven't thought about and are concerned with, and not just our suppliers, but the end-level suppliers, our suppliers to our suppliers, and so forth and so on, back down the chain. Right. It only takes one of those to be breached for us to have a vulnerability that we may not even have known about. That's a really difficult question. The mechanisms I've seen put in place are, to some extent, good, but not good enough. I wouldn't even say they're adequate. They're just all we could think about right now. For example, we give a checklist to a company and we say, check off all the things you're doing. Tell us the things you're not doing. There's an audit. We're going to come in and audit you and make sure that you've done the things you said you've done. Of course, we know that cyber is a dynamic problem. So even if you're secure today, let's just suppose it's okay to audit someone's systems and you're okay today. That doesn't mean you're okay tomorrow. It's dynamic. It's a changing thing. I don't have the answer myself to the broader ecosystem. My personal thoughts, I mean, I haven't researched it. My personal thoughts are things like be an example and to have consequences and have ways to help your ecosystem. I know there's some companies have spun up programs. One company I'm thinking of in particular has spun up a nonprofit to help small and medium businesses who are their suppliers be more secure. And what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Well, they don't just say, here's a checklist, go figure it out. They say, here's a checklist of things we need to make sure you do, and here's how we can help you do it. And here's what you need in your organization. Since you're a small and medium business and you have one person that runs all your technology, including cyber, and you've outsourced everything to the cloud, we know you don't have the resource to do this, but to work with us, we got to make sure you're not a vulnerability. So let us work with you on it. And they've been quite successful in providing tools and techniques for their small and medium businesses and a broader community of small and medium businesses that might benefit from ways to think about cyber. So I've seen that tool work. I mean, when I say work, it's almost in quotes because it's pretty new and very broad. But the issue here that you're bringing up is we really need to raise all boats, and we need some creative, innovative ways to raise all boats. And let me just add one other piece here. I think we, as the good guys, are kind of at a disadvantage because we're the good guys. The bad guys, they are just willing to share information. They're willing to help each other. They're willing to, you know, for a price, go in and implement a cyber attack on a company for somebody else if necessary. They share information much better than we do. They're organized much better than we are. So as the good guys, we're a little bit behind the times here. We're trying to keep up with a ever-changing set of bad actors. And we need to start thinking a little bit more like that. You know, how do we organize ourselves so that we can share information, even though it might open up other vulnerabilities with our regulators or other vulnerabilities with our suppliers? I don't know what the answer is, but the challenge is really we need to be thinking a little bit more dynamic about this situation rather than all about protecting ourselves.
I think you're right. I think that, I mean, audit still has a role to play, but I think if COVID taught us one thing, it's that if you're going to be reliant on auditing other than in person, then you're going to miss stuff. And so we have to move beyond, I think, that concept of audit into that role of trust, into that role of sharing. And certainly one of the things that I'm very keen to promote from my organization's standpoint is this concept of, as you've just outlined, the big guys taking responsibility for helping out the smaller guys. And in our world, that means, you know, we have something called a supply chain membership, that the supplier, the main organization, can help the smaller organization, being I'm part of the ISF, under the auspice of the organization they're working with. And we see that as having potential benefit going forward.
I think that's awesome that you have this, where it's a really great idea. I'm going to use that in another example next time someone asks me about it, where the big guy joins the organization and all the suppliers are members. I think that's a really clever, creative idea.
One of the things I was going to ask you was, because you mentioned threat actors, bad actors, was about breaches. So you're researching how organizations mitigate cyber breaches. Tell us about that, because that is something that really does keep people up at night. You know, what have you found in your research, and what are some of the best practices pre and post breach?
Yeah, that's a really good question too. So a few years ago, before COVID, my colleagues and I did a paper on cyber breaches as a service. I can't remember the exact title. It's published in Sloan Management Review about how the dark web is really well organized. And, you know, I don't have to tell your audience that it's no longer somebody sitting in hoodies with tattoos and piercings in a dark room with the screen blaring, trying to attack our organizations. It could be anyone. It could be just a general business person with bad scruples who wants to break into a company or steal assets. I think the best, I guess I would say the best defense here is an offense. It's being resilient. Right. And lately I've been writing more about, don't think about this as protecting yourselves from the bad guys, but think of this as building resilience in your organization. And to some extent that applies to the supply chain too. Instead of assuming we're going to keep the bad guys out, because we know we can't do that. We just know that the more clever we get, the more clever they get. And now we've got AI tools and potentially quantum technologies floating around that we don't even know how they're going to be used, but we know they're going to be used to break into our systems. So we've got to come up with a resiliency plan. And I would say instead of focusing on cyber protection, we focus on cyber resiliency. I published a couple articles on that, one at Sloan earlier this year, one recently in Harvard Business Review, about what does that look like? Because it may not look that different to the technology person building a budget for their cybersecurity, because they're thinking protection includes response and recovery. But it's very different for the manager who's investing in cybersecurity and says, how many bad guys are we going to keep out? You know, what's the risk of a bad guy getting in if we make this investment? The question they should be asking is, what's our biggest business risk and what are we doing about it? You know, what's our biggest technology risk and what are we doing about it? Not how much money can we spend to be more protected? I think that's a secondary, maybe even a third level question that we want to ask. We want to look at what are the mechanisms for building cyber resilience. And I think that includes a heavier dose of response and maybe even a heavier dose of recovery, putting things in place like tabletop exercises more often where we practice. So we build that muscle mass about how we're going to respond to an incident, making sure that we know who's going to help us in all events, not just in the event that we're the only company that experienced a breach, but if our whole ecosystem experienced a breach, we may not be able to count on some of the people we were going to count on. If our whole geographical city experienced a breach, we may not be able to count on our local resources that we were going to count on. So thinking about breaches and thinking about resiliency, I believe, is really the most sane way to approach cybersecurity today.
And the tabletop thing really does work. I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, that is probably one of our most popular services. We have run those now from Australia right the way through to North America and all places in between. And the value that people derive from that is that it brings together the C-suite with the guys who are actually doing the work come the day that the breach happens, right? And they rarely do that. They rarely get to see that perspective. And that is so important for the day when the breach actually happens. So it's good to hear you endorsing that one as well for our listeners.
Well, let me add to that, Steve. I think the tabletop exercise is also a potential solution for your ecosystem question.
All right,
don't just bring the guys from your organization in, you know, your cyber people with your C-level people. Your boards need to be part of this, some of your suppliers, maybe even some of your top customers, so that they see how you would respond in the event of an emergency. Now, I don't mean bring your customers in and scare them. I mean, bring your customers in and show them that you're ready, that you're resilient, that should this happen to you, this is what you would do for them, because they're worried about you also. You're their supplier. So I think tabletop exercises and fire drills, I also wrote a paper about that a couple years ago, different ways, different levels. It's not the same exact exercise, and I'm sure your organization has multiple different ones, but it's not the same exact exercise for the C-suite as it is for the board, as it is for the operating managers. And all of them need to practice. You don't want to wait until a breach to know if your business continuity plans are even available. We have one story of a company where their business continuity plans were great, extensive, and on the computer. And when they got ransomed and everything was locked up, nobody had access to the business continuity plans. Well, if they had practiced, they might have realized that you probably don't want to leave them locked up on a computer. You probably want to have them somewhere else. And of course, it's dynamic. So you want to make sure your processes include updating of your business continuity plans in the event of a cyber incident, in the event of new kinds of cyber incidents.
Yeah, some really good points you make there, Carrie, particularly about don't have it all on the computer, because the computer won't be available. I'm sure many people listening to this are sort of shaking their heads at the moment going, yeah, if only I'd thought that one through beforehand. Before we go, one of the things I just wanted to touch on was this issue of talent. Because we've spoken for so long now in the industry about a shortage of skill sets. What is your view on the pipeline of talent coming into the industry right now?
Well, I'm at MIT, which is, of course, a great technology school. We don't teach people to be cybersecurity leaders. There's no course. There's no program. You can't get a degree in cybersecurity at MIT. You can get a degree in the technologies that would be really important in being both secure, protected, and resilient. You can get a degree in management, and there are some courses you could take that would open up your eyes to cybersecurity. There's a lot of entrepreneurship going on to help people spin up companies that would provide new technologies. I see a lot of activity in the trade space and in schools that have programs for cybersecurity. One program I'm familiar with is over at Boston College, does a great job teaching cybersecurity leadership and managers. Shout out to them, I guess. There's a number of schools that do that. NYU and many other schools have programs like that. But those are, I think, really still a drop in the bucket. I think that the answer to the talent problem, there's two levels. One is the actual talent that's going to sit in our SOCs and, you know, do our penetration testing and make sure our identity and access management controls are correct. Those kinds of talent, we have lots of programs. We actually did spin up one through our X-Pro external education program. It's a 24-week boot camp. I actually designed it to help people understand what it would be like to be in cybersecurity with the hope that it would entice people to be in cybersecurity, and then they'd go deeper into whatever area excited them, offensive, defensive, leadership, culture, whatever it might be. But there are many places you can go to learn those things, and I think they're really helpful. But I think the secondary piece is what we've just talked about, Steve, building a culture. I think every single person in the organization needs a little bit of cybersecurity in them. I don't mean that our, you know, customer service people need to be picking firewalls or even involved in firewall discussions, but they need to be just a little bit more aware and just a little bit more resilient themselves. Because I think the only way we're going to solve the cyber problem is by having a very strong set of defenses, defense in depth, and resiliency strategies. And I think that's the direction we need to be thinking about. So we need the talent, and there are ways and more ways coming online every day. But I think we need to be thinking broader than that to keep our companies resilient.
Because cyber resilience is everybody's job, right? And that's the message I think we have to get across and help people relate to and implement, not just in their working lives, but in their lives in general, because digital is certainly the way that life will be continuing to develop, I would suggest. You heard it here first. Carrie, been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time and also sharing some of those great case study insights, which I'm sure our listeners are going to find very, very valuable. So, Carrie, thank you again.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you to today's guest, Dr. Carrie Pearlson. We'll be back next week with a new episode. In the meantime, listeners, will you take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening and give us a 5-star rating? If you have a little more time, write a review. That really helps new listeners find us. So thanks. We invite you to listen to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in-depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.